sitting here while we were talking and listening to Dylan, and I was straight the flashback of Dylan. I don't know whether many of the listeners remember when Dylan first came on the scene.
Probably a lot of
them. But I remember the first time I heard Dylan, and it was back about 1960 or 61.
Yeah.
When I heard Dylan for the first time, someone came into a party in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and said,
just broke up the whole party, got this out-of-sight record, you gotta hear this, this is just, you'll never believe it, it's just fantastic, and the whole party just broke right up, and we all sat and listened to Dylan and said, this has gotta be the greatest thing that's happened to music in 50 years, and
it was.
We were right, and
right.
It was.
That was just about the same way I heard him the first time. There was a gathering, and a guy brought the album in, and he said, you have got to hear this album.
And he was right. We just had to hear the album. Fantastic. To get back to present times, they've done it.
We said they would, and they did.
And they did. I just came from talking to the media people and told them what I thought about the situation. I told them that I suppose I can say the same things directly on the air.
Morris, I would like to ask you a question.
Sure,
before you
sure.
Get into it. I have, I've rapped with you personally.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're not what I would consider close friends or anything, but we have rapped a little bit and been around each other somewhat, and I find you to be, this is something that Bob Dunn and I were talking about. He was a gentleman who covered the hearings for the station, and we were talking about the fact that you are not a power mad type person who was seeking the publicity that you have gained through this thing, and you're actually a person who just wanted to be free to state your own ideas when you wanted to state them and to teach your classes the way you had wanted to teach them, and you weren't a publicity mad type person.
I'm glad that you're aware of that. There are a lot of people who aren't aware of that, and I'm glad that you used the word, you know, power. One of the things that I'm opposed to in our society and in the world at large is the fact that social organizations are power organizations, that people are related through mechanism of power. I'm opposed to that. That's essentially the bottom of my whole political outlook.
Well, this is something that we said, and
that's the thing we've got to abolish. We've got to abolish power relationships, and we've got to create a society, a world society, in which human relationships replace power relationships.
I agree.
And that's number one on the agenda, or we're all done. We're all finished. And that's a hard thing to do. And about the publicity thing, I think that it's inevitable in any movement of any kind, any mass struggle for any kind of social change. The movement is going to throw up leaders. The movement's going to generate leaders.
It seems, though, that the movement didn't generate you. It seems that the question, I was going to take it a little further, the newspapers and the TV and radio facilities here in Phoenix gave you an immense amount of publicity.
Yeah, well, I think...
And I think they put you in the position you're in rather than the movement putting
you
there.
I think that's inevitable. I think what happens is that people emerge out of a struggle, and the media picks up on those people that emerge out of a struggle, and for good or ill, the media picks up on people that emerge out of the struggle as spokesmen for something or other, and not necessarily one person, maybe four or five people, maybe different people, and for different reasons. But what happens is, invariably, there's a kind of mistake that goes on in the people's minds against whom the struggle is directed. They think that those people who the media picks out as the spokesmen or the leaders with a big capital L are the cause of the movement.
This is where they really mess up.
This is where they really mess up, and they try to victimize those people and hope by getting rid of those people that they'll make the movement go away.
And
but
I think
they've got another guest coming. The movement's not going away.
I think the Chicago 8 and you are two really prime examples of it. For instance, Jerry Rubin is a well-known person in the movement. But Jerry Rubin definitely is not the leader in the movement, you know.
No, I don't think that he is. I don't think there are any the leaders in the movement.
Don't
and I think that's
I
good.
I hope not.
I like to think of the movement as a movement of leaders. And you know, if everybody's a leader, then nobody's a follower.
Right.
And that's healthy. But the people that you know, have a lot at stake here in power-oriented, power-related, and privilege-oriented societies, don't understand that, and they want to always pick on somebody who the press focuses on for one reason or another. Maybe something that it's easier for them, or they can understand or relate to this person or that person better, and they glom onto that guy, and then the people, as I say, people think, let's get him out of the way and we'll save the whole show. But as I say, they're sadly mistaken. This movement is not going to stop. The anti-war movement's bigger than it ever was, and you can count on your both hands the so-called leaders in the anti-war movement. They're all different people. They come and go. Some are leaders for a while, or so-called leaders for a while, fade back. Some others start speaking out in turn. And yet the movement keeps growing, and they rip off people all the time. The black struggle is growing. Black people are becoming more aware of themselves as an oppressed national minority. They're going to try to, you know, get themselves together and relate to each other, and then you know, forge an identity through which they can relate to, you know, a racist society, and you know, they keep ripping off leaders, you know, but it isn't gonna stop it. That's not the way social change takes place,
I think Hitler is a really good example of Hitler through his means could change things, could force his changes on the public for a while, but not really for long.
Well, that's another kind of problem.
It's a different kind of movement, but the point is that it was not a movement of the people.
That's the key to that. It was eventually overthrown. It was a movement that used the people.
Right.
It was essentially a ruler movement to try to keep things from getting out of hand, and he was there, and he fit the picture, fit the bill, fit the needs, but it wasn't a movement of the people. And this, I think, is what's happening in America. Masses are in motion. Masses of young people, masses of students, blacks, middle-aged people against the war. Businessmen now are coming into this for their own reasons.
The president of DuPont, believe it or not, made a speech against the Vietnam War.
Yeah, what's happened is really kind of exciting in a way. What's happened is that all the arguments against the war have now coalesced. The moral argument, the political argument,
the economic
argument, you name it. Every single argument is now down to the same conclusion. We got to get out. We got to get out now. We got to stop all that killing and leave those people alone.
I don't really feel that the war is as important as the implications of the war, the implications of the fact that this war has been carried on as long as it has, the implications of the fact that the amendment that is now before the Congress of the United States that Nixon is in favor of, and I forget the name of it, but it's much like the Gulf of Tonkin Revolution.
It was the Byrd Amendment to the Cooper Church Amendment we just heard on the news.
Was it beaten today?
But what's interesting is that it's an amendment that the government supported, which reveals the government's the Nixon government's hand in this. I mean, they supported it. They wanted to cut the ground out from under the Cooper Church thing. They'll probably find some way to cut the ground out from under it if it's passed without any amendment. They haven't changed their policy. The government hasn't changed its policy basically from Johnson's time.
No.
It's still the same old basic policy of we're going to win. We're going to preserve the kind of property relations and the kind of governmental structure on those people that we want. that they want, Washington want.
Actually worse than Johnson, because Johnson made one statement once, and he said, I will never wrap the flag around my arm to protect myself from my decisions on the Vietnam War. I will stand and fall on my decisions and not on the American flag.
And that's what we're getting now.
That's exactly what's coming down now. If you disagree with the government policies now, you are...
Well, Johnson tried that for a while, and it failed. That was repudiated by the people, and I think that Mitchellism is being repudiated by the people, too.
Hopefully.
Nobody wants to hear that. They've tried to build a climate because of the lies, and that's another thing about the war. It's not just the war and the killing. The lies that have been used to justify it, the myths that have been created and that are being exploded, and the fantastic commitment to pursuing this kind of war in the face of unbelievable problems at home that need solution desperately strikes me as being incredible. But one has to understand that in terms of the rationale, their rationale, I mean, at first it looked reasonable from their point of view. It looked reasonable in terms of keeping foreign countries open for investment. You make a lot of bread at home, and you got to do something with it to make more, because that's the name of the game. And so what do? You go over to an underdeveloped nation, and where there's people there who are unable to resist working for 20 cents a day, and you set up your factories, and you put a few people in power to keep things cool, and you draw off all kinds of money that you then dump somewhere else. Well, they have to keep that going everywhere, and they figure, well, they can keep it pretty easily going. It wouldn't take long to keep these people down and prevent them from getting the kind of changes that desperately need being made in their own country. Land reform, number one. And that's impossible given our role in there. And so what do we fighting against the whole people. You end up fighting against a whole nation and passing it off as a war against aggression, which is just insanity. But that's the sort of thing. And little by little, it became clear to some people who were at first for the war, some people who figured that, well, they'll in the long run it'll be okay, are now seeing that in the long run it will not be okay. You got a split among the very people who stood at first to gain from the war.
In the long run, it has been a long run already.
It has been a long run. It's been an unbelievable disaster. I mean, in a sense, it's lost already. And if they just make up their mind to give it up once and for all, and recognize that third world people, colonial people, are not going to have this anymore. They're not going to have foreigners come into their country and keep them backward or develop what they want developed, but that the people in these countries are going to develop their own, lives and their own lifestyles and their own ways.
Their
own cultures and their own ways. It would be nice, but I don't think we're going to see an end to this. As rational, from our point of view, as an end to this is, I don't think we're going to see an end to this until many millions more Americans decide that it's got to stop. I mean, the students alone aren't going to do it. Young people alone aren't going to do it. A few businessmen alone aren't going to do it. Just zillions and zillions of people, everyday average people who go to work and come home and watch the killing on TV are going to have to say, I'm paying for this, inflation is whittling away at my salary, my kids are next, I've had it, I don't want it anymore. And we're going to have to start seeing some out and out labor strikes against this war. We're going to have to start seeing people who are going to say, you want a war? Okay, we're not going to work. And then I think they'll come around and start pulling people out. Students alone can't do it. Students have got to start relating to people work.
Spreading out in the academic community.
Get it outside the high schools. Get it outside the universities. Get it to the people who work in the stores, who work in the factories, who work in the fields. Explain it to them in their own terms. And don't try to use our own jargon and our own rhetoric. And get it to where people can understand it, relate to them, to their needs, to their problems, to their concerns, and they'll move. I have a lot of faith in the American people. That's something that that's my conception of patriotism. I don't have any faith in the rulers, but I have a lot of faith in the people. Everybody's so uptight about people who don't pledge flags and who, don't bow and scrape to the so-called leaders and so-called authority figures in the society. They're not the country. It's the people.
They never have been.
And I have a lot of faith in the people. And I think the people are gonna move. And sure, they've been terribly brainwashed. It's just incredible. The amount of brainwashing that has come down for a long, long time on all these political things. There's a real sense in which...
And they use media just like this just like this.
The manipulation, the overt and the subtle forms of ideological and political manipulation in this country are so sophisticated that in a real sense they almost don't need to have. Everybody talks about police state. They almost don't need to have to resort to an open police state. It's so coolly done. But reality has a way of breaking into that. Even the most fantasized society, even the most, psychotic society, in a real sense, a society which is living on myth, living on illusions, living on some other reality. So reality has a way of breaking into that and getting people to think and evaluate on their own and getting them together when the objective conditions come right in on people heavy. They get together and they start talking to each other and they start relating to each other and they start saying, wait a minute, it's got to cease. And I think, this goes back to my thing too, to my case. I think
Can I do something
sure,
right here?
Sure.
I need to say this is KCAC in Phoenix, and I would like to ask you...
Radio Free Phoenix.
Right, man. For a while, anyway.
For a while.
I would like to ask you something as long as we're on the subject of media. There has been a lot of animosity against you in the press, Morris.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't find you objectionable as a person.
I don't think the reporters do either. It's really fantastic. When I'm talking to the people from the media, the reporters from the media, it's really a very beautiful thing. I mean, we talk and we seem to understand. We don't necessarily agree. I don't expect people to agree with me about everything. That would be sort of a dull thing.
But what happens when it comes, for instance, I follow the Pulliam Press. I'll just totally leave mm-hmm. that out of it. I mean, everybody knows where they're at. But even on television... the newscasts, and on radio, the newscasts, they refer to you as, quote, the radical professor, and they place all of these terms describing you that are very negative terms.
Well, the terms I use about myself, because I don't disagree with them on that.
It's the way the stories are structured,
right,
though,
it's
Morris.
The way the stories are structured.
Right. I have been in the media for
right.
7 years, man, and I know.
Yeah. They don't do that. That is, at least to my knowledge. You probably know more about it than I do, but I think that the working press is every bit as much aware of the kind of manipulation as we are. They can't do anything about it. They try. I mean, they've been tremendous with me, but as the working press themselves have been just absolutely fantastic on this case. But their hands are tied too. They're not free either. They've got to work or starve too. That's the name of our game. It's the work or starve game. It's the you play by my rules or you're out game that got me, you see. And so they have to, they've got to eat and they've got to survive. And I, again, I I said, it's this deep faith in the American people. The press are going to be, when it really starts coming push to shove, on our side. Because they know they're not free. They know they're not free to say what has to be said, to do what has to be done. Last May in France, if you remember, there was almost a revolution last May in France. The press took over. They took over the media. The reporters and the disc jockeys and the news analysts and the newspaper people, the radios, TVs, and papers were all worker-controlled. They told the editors and the censors and the owners, that's it. We're now saying it like it is.
Which is as it should be.
It's as it should be, all the time. And it can't be, because you got a guy who owns the paper, and he's got, you know, a vested interest in having certain beliefs held in the view, in public beliefs held, because they shore up. And just a trivial example, I mean, that runs the gamut of the media to all the way to the schools, and runs through everything. One of the myths of the little piece of paper, the property paper, the little myth that our whole society hinges on, that because somebody has a little piece of paper that says he owns, you know, a piece of land that's productive, or a factory that's productive, or something that's productive, that he has the absolute right of life and death over people in it, or on it, or work for it. And you know, that myth's got to be protected, because once the people, the real people of this country, start to question that myth, then it just becomes a little piece of paper again.
Which is all it is.
Which is all it is. And then they'll just crumple it up, throw it away, and say, it's ours, baby, it's ours. We're going to work it our way and share it. And it's all over then. All they can do is walk away from it. Well, so they've got to protect those myths in the schools, and on the air, and everywhere else. And there's a lot of them. That's not the only ones. A lot of them. And people who challenge those myths, and people who expose the illusions which keep things as they are the first people to get victimized. And what happens when these illusions get blown is exactly what happened in this case, is that what's revealed is that the whole thing rests, when the illusions go, the whole thing rests on force.
Right.
Power and force. The little cliche that I used in Tucson, which the speech that triggered off the whole thing, is if they can't con you, they'll try to buy you. And if they can't buy you, they'll hit you over the head.
Which they do.
Which they do.
One thing I would like to talk to you about. You were, your life was threatened recently when you were about to speak at the rally.
I didn't
on
hear
Memorial
that.
Day.
I didn't hear that.
Really?
Oh.
You were protected by security guards.
Well, it's not because of the threat. I think that was because they were afraid that, not that I, you know, be, you know, off, you know, some assassin type thing, but that, you know, I'd maybe be beaten up or something. And I think that that wouldn't go down well. And I think that they're conscious of that, and I think they simply made a political decision that better give him some protection, because it really wouldn't look good if you know, some people got to him.
There was a, I don't remember whether it was a letter or an article, Morris, in the paper, and someone commented on the fact that you were guarded by security guards, campus security guards.
Yeah, two campus security guards.
And they said it was really strange that you, who had called the police pigs, would be guarded by those pigs. That was the thing I wanted to mention.
Yeah, I never call the police pigs. I don't think that's a very helpful term with respect to the people that we have to get to understand the nature of police power. we, again, you know, it might be a very in thing to refer to police as pigs, but most Americans believe that the police are neutral. Most Americans believe that the state is neutral, and that his government is neutral, that the machinery, that the courts are neutral, and that all our, you know, institutions of law enforcement, our legal structure is neutral. And they really do think unfortunately do think in terms of, you know, quote, good police and bad police. It's very difficult to get, difficult enough to get people to understand that the police are an instrument of oppression. They're an instrument that's part of a whole structure to preserve social relations the way they are.
Probably one of the most pressured groups in America also.
Yeah, and that often they're used as an instrument of repression. And it's not a question, really, of good or bad. That's always a tactic that they decide on, or that the people who give them orders decide on, whether they're going to be good guys or bad guys. It depends really on the nature of the confrontation, the nature of the political situation. I don't object the situation that happened at Mate on May 30th. But at the same time, I mean, if the situation were really scary, I wouldn't rely. I mean, if under different circumstances. I mean, here it was obviously on the campus security. It would be very bad politically if anything happened. But in a situation where it wouldn't be bad politically to happen, I don't think I'd have, I'd feel that secure. I think I'd want to, you know, have some people around that I knew and that I could count on. I'm not a pacifist. I don't put down violence because I'm a pacifist. There are other reasons for putting down violence. But I certainly do believe in self-defense, and I certainly do believe that people have a right to protect themselves and to keep other people from harming them and physically harming them. To go back to the pig thing, I don't think that it helps. It's hard enough to get this across to people anyway. But when you add jargon to it, when you add words to it that people can't relate to, then it makes it even harder to understand what you're telling them about the role of the police. To make it very concrete, you see, the Colosseum is public property. I mean, a couple of weeks ago, some people were out there. There's a rock concert. Some people were out there leafleting for the May 30th thing, and there they were, the police ordering people off public property, not allowing them to leaflet on public property. Again, on orders from a group of people, small group of people who control the Colosseum, it's very hard for people to understand, well, it's public property. I mean, why should that happen? But then you have to reflect that in our society, there really isn't much difference between public property and private property. They're both controlled by the people who control the private property.
Right.
The people who are on that board of the Colosseum, just like the people who are on the board of Regents, are also people in high positions on private boards of corporations, and so they, you know, essentially function as the owners of both kind of property.
Tell me something, Morris. How is it that Jack Williams got on the board of Regents? It would seem to me that someone who is in a political office would immediately disqualify himself if he were not already disqualified by some ruling.
I haven't read it, but I think that's official. I mean, that the governor has a seat on the Board of Regents. I think that's automatic.
I think that's wrong.
I also think that the regents shouldn't be appointed. I think they should be elected.
I do too.
And I mean, I'd like to see the regents abolished. I'd like to see the whole thing abolished and universities run directly by students and faculty with administrators to cooperate with the paperwork. That's kind of a long way off. One good step would be to have regents elected, be awfully nice, you see, if there were some black people on the regents. The university is a public institution. It's supported by everybody's taxes, and it's treated as the private property of people who have essentially very narrow interests. Mine people and corporation people are on that, but there aren't any workers on it. There's nobody from that I know of who's a member of a trade union on it to look after, worker interests. There's no blacks, no Chicanos, no students.
None of the people that really have anything to do
really
with
serious,
the university.
Yeah, because if you're claiming that your university is a public university to serve the people, then there ought to be people on there whose interests are being looked after that you're claiming to serve, and this isn't the case. And I think it isn't the case in general. I don't think that the universities around the country are serving the needs of the people. I don't think that they're being run, they're being operated in terms of the needs and aspirations, for example, the students. That's the last person that's considered. He's just an object and there to be processed. That's his thing. If he doesn't, and if he steps out of that mold, if he folds or mutilates himself, he's thrown out of the computer, throws him out. That's his role, and the faculty are there to do the processing, and God forbid, they don't want to process people but educate them, and that's subversive. And so in general, that's the whole campus situation right now across the country. Is we've got a situation where universities are not serving the people, either the students or the poor people or the Chicanas, the blacks, the interests of people all over the world, because you've got to have broaden our outlook. It's not enough anymore to have just a national outlook. That's too narrow. We've got to start thinking in terms of the world. And the universities aren't relating to the problems of the world and to the needs and the aspirations of people.
This isn't only true in the United States either.
That's right.
It's true everywhere.
Yeah,
Mexico. Look at Mexico.
Student revolt is worldwide. It's not only going on in the so-called West, it's also going on in the East. Students there are being processed. They don't like it. The students in the East are certainly not anti-socialist or anti-communist, as our press would like to make it out that they are, but they're having trouble making out that. The students over there have read all the things that socialists or communists have written, and they're saying, this ain't it. And we're tired of being told that it's it, and we want the real thing. And I think that a lot of students are in this country are coming to the same conclusion by a different route. They're seeing that what they've been told is socialism or communism is not what is being called over there, socialism or communism is not, but that what it really is okay. And people have lied to them about it for a long time, and they don't like that. And they're turning to it as an alternative, both over there, which is really ironic, both over there, it's an alternative to what they've got, which is some kind of post-capitalist aberration, but certainly isn't communism or socialism. And here, a lot of students are turning to it as an alternative to really a system that's in its last stages of bizarre defense mechanism action. Almost free associating words. It's sort of like it's up against the wall and it knows it, and it's just thrashing and lashing out and is gonna put down or kill or destroy anybody in a frantic effort to save itself. But it's a lost cause. And,
Anytime when things get to the point where you have to kill to save something,
yeah,
then it is.
Yeah, it's pretty desperate.
Know.
And they really are getting very desperate. I mean, when the president of the United States refers to students who have rejected a certain set of values and who are counterposing to that set of values of values of genuine humanity, he refers to them as bums, in a sense gives a license to people to go shoot them down,
right?
Then you've really got a desperate situation in the country, a very desperate, when black people can be just treated abysmally all over, and you know, there's just no, you know, no recourse that they have. You've really got a desperate situation.
Did you read the report on the that was released? There was an article on it yesterday in the paper concerning the so-called snipers at Kent State and Jackson.
No, I didn't.
There
weren't any.
No, there weren't. The federal authorities have even admitted that there has been no evidence presented to substantiate any reports of sniping.
Yeah, and there's a lesson to be learned there, too. I mean, not an obvious one, but I think a little deeper one, that they wouldn't have done that. They wouldn't have been forced to that kind of admission if it hadn't been for the kind of reaction. I'm convinced that the only really important weapon that we have now, I don't believe that the political power comes out of the muzzle of a gun, and a lot of people are saying that, and I think that's wrong. And I don't believe that we're in for a period of fascism. I think that's crazy. People who say that we're either a fascist society or on the verge of becoming a fascist society didn't live through the 50s, and when it was a lot worse than it is now. And it's a lot better than it was then, because we have really an important weapon that isn't a gun. We have the consciousness, or the developing consciousness, and the independent organization of masses of people. That really is the ultimate weapon. When people react all over the country to a Kent, to a Cambodia, to Kent, to Jackson, just, you know, spontaneously react, things have got to give. They're forced to drop the mythology. They're forced to admit what's going on. They're forced to take a stand, because after all, people do believe these illusions and take them seriously. I take them seriously. I think that they ought to be made real. They shouldn't just be illusions. Of, you know, freedom and democracy and genuine choice and things of that
sort.
And but you know, what we're saying is, you know, that in effect, what we do when we spontaneously act and demonstrate this way in the streets, go into the streets as a mass of independent political people, we force them to live up to the illusion, and that's tough for them to swallow. But they have to swallow it or admit what they've got going for them, and they don't want to do that, because that would blow the whole thing.
They're not going to do that.
They're not going to do that. So that's the thing that we have to keep remembering. People, you know, say, oh, all is lost, or all is hopeless, or I'm, you know, not going to do this, or I'm not going to do that, or there's no way, or there is a way. The anti-war movement is a fantastic example of this. Just getting all those people together and getting them out. It's got the people in power plenty scared.
Strange, the people in power keep falling back on the same old things. If you remember back in Mississippi when the civil rights workers were killed several years back,
mm-hmm.
Oxford Town, everybody's got to head bowed down.
Yeah.
The state of Mississippi refused to answer questions concerning their deaths. They refused to turn over any material. The same thing has happened about the Jackson State incident. It was reported that the governor has refused to let any of the highway patrolmen be interviewed.
Mm.
And he has also refused to turn over any information to the federal
government. I see now mass public pressure can force them to do that, even though, you see, it would be against their own interest to do that. Mass public pressure, you know, telegrams, letters, marches, that's the sort of thing that, that ultimately does have a lot more weight than people realize. It causes a good deal of embarrassment to the other people that run things, and they say, look, you better do that, and, you know, that's because you're causing us trouble up here, and we can't, you know, allow you to do what you've done. Now there's too much. And this is the way things move. Once the public comes down, once the people come down heavy on something that they, that some segment of the people who run things think they can get away with, you see, then they're told by the cooler ones, look, if we're going to save the whole ball game, you can't get away with that. So we'll have to stop that from happening. You're going to have to stop just shooting down people, or you're going to have to stop just, you know, rousting people. Whenever any kind of repression comes down on any level against anybody, if we all act together on it, then they say, uh-oh, we can't do that, have to move it over. And gradually, you move them over against their will, and they have to keep shrinking back farther and farther, and they can't come down with these things. That's the way to fight repression. You don't fight repression by, you know, offing people, or by, you know, offing buildings, or, you know, trashing things. You fight repression by explaining to people, you know, what the repression is all about, and by getting them to act together, and by showing people clearly how an act of repression against one is an act of repression against everybody. And you get whole ranges, broad segments of people together against the repression, and they gotta stop it. They gotta stop it.
I think that in the last 5 years that the United States government has proven nothing else. It has proven that the use of force and the use of shooting people down, the use of guns and the use of war will not stop a people. And I think that this is a lesson that the movement leaders should really, really understand, the fact that we cannot take guns in against them and change things that way, because they have been unable to do it to us. I think we, in this, by the same token, will be unable to use
the movement has to keep constantly educating itself and educating the new people that come into the movement, essentially our secret weapon is our solidarity, our strength in number, and our ability to get lots of people out not doing business as usual, whatever the business may be, just stopping things, or maybe even one step further, transforming business as usual to anti-business as usual. I'll give you an example. For a long time, the slogan of student strikes against the war around the country has been shut it down. But a whole new dimension has been added to the student anti-war movement in this Cambodia Kent week. College after college, university after university, the slogan immediately went, because so many people were involved that it was no longer a trick to shut it down. They were just shut down instantly. The slogan went from shut it down to open it up as an anti-war university,
right,
as a reconstituted university, as our own university that serves our needs. Essentially what happened was that in places where there really wasn't very much of a radical movement, all of a sudden you found, right after the shut it down period, an open it up period, a taking over of facilities, a total democratization of the university, use of facilities for the anti-war movement, educational facilities as well as physical facilities. All kinds of classes were reconstituted to talk about what students wanted to talk about. Literature classes were relating problems in literature to problems of war and poverty today. Philosophy classes were, you know, abandoned the old conception of the abstract that alienated philosophy, start talking about philosophical issues of today's needs. Architecture and art classes just abandoned the whole thing of designing buildings for big architectural firms and started thinking in terms of, well, how can we relate architecture to the movement? What can we do to design maybe at the lowest level, a new kind of poster, or at the highest level, let's relate architecture to ecology and see what we can do about the ecological crisis with respect, given our own trade and our own skills. Now, this happened at university after university. That's a whole new dimension to the anti-war struggle. And that's the secret weapon. The secret weapon is essentially the democracy in the movement that reaches out through solidarity, through collective effort this way, and democratizes the institutions from below, and says, you're not going to run these institutions your way to serve your needs and your political purposes and your material interests. We're going to use them to serve our needs in terms not of somebody else's fears out there in the state capitol, but of our aspirations. And it's just changed the radical movement in this country overnight. The next step is going to be to solidify this. Whenever it breaks out again at any university, it won't be just for a few days. It'll be institutionalized that kind of democratization and reconstitution of the university will become a fact, a permanent fact of university life, which is, I see as just unbelievably significant, because I do believe that universities are important. I don't think I don't agree with some of the people who think that universities should be abandoned.
No.
And destroyed.
No,
brought
no.
down. Universities are really very important. If a new culture is going to emerge, out of the figurative ruins of the old culture, then it's going to emerge in its forms are going to generate out of the student struggle. The forms of the new culture are going to generate there at the university and are going to reach out. And then it seems to me when the people who do the productive work in the society, when the conditions of their life become as impossible as the conditions of student life have become for students, then they'll look. They won't be out smashing students. They'll be looking to the students and looking to the forms, the democratic forms that the students are throwing up, establishing, and the new cultural forms. They're going to look to them for a pattern, a model, and you'll see it happening there. You'll see changes in the lifestyle and the work style and of people who work. I don't believe the generation gap. I think that's a myth.
I don't either.
It's
communication gap is all it is.
It's a communication gap. It's a political gap. It's a where your head is gap. That's where it is. And more and more people are starting to see it that way and starting to relate to each other that way. And I'm a very optimistic person. There's so many people that are so gloomy about all these things that are going to be so bad. I think when we look back on it 5 years from now, we're going to see that things are going to be, 5 light years better and not worse. We're on the verge, no matter how they lie about it, we're on the verge of having, for the first time in the history of this country, democratically, not through elections, that's a fake, but democratically through the essentially the power of the masses of this country, stopping the war. Now, the masses have never declared a war anywhere, and they've never stopped a war in this country. This is a unique development. It's an act of democratization of the death machinery, which is a necessary step to an abolition of the death machinery. If we get control of that death machinery, we can stop the death machinery and rebuild in terms of life machinery. But first we've got to democratize, and that means taking away that war-making power, putting it in our hands, and we've done it without, constitutional amendments and without, elections, just in terms of people, talking to people and getting people to not accept and people seeing that, not accepting the lies and forcing them farther and farther along a path where eventually they're going to just have to stop it. Now that's, to me, something that's unprecedented.
It is.
And I think that, that social revolutions are made not on defeats, not on on provoking, you know, guard to come in, and not on, on being victimized. Social revolutions are built on victories, maybe subtle victories, maybe victories that aren't quite visible, but they're built on victories just like this. They're built on victories of masses, not of individual people, but of victories of masses involved in a struggle. And little by little, the struggle gets to a point where it gets to a quantitative point where all of a sudden a new, it emerges to a qualitative difference. Sort of like gas. You put pressure on gas, more and more pressure, and then all of a sudden the gas becomes a liquid. Just by increasing the pressure, the quantitative change. And it seems to me that this is the way social, deep-rooted, not just ephemeral changes, but deep-rooted human changes take place, where little by little quantitative changes occur, and all of a sudden they amount to a significant qualitative change. I think that we're living, and this is not original with me, but I'm sure a lot of people haven't heard it put this way before. We're living in the last stages of prehistory.
Right.
By prehistory I mean the not quite human history. We're just on the last stages of evolving toward human beings. And little by little, and it's going to be rough and there'll be setbacks, but little by little we're going to pass through the stage of prehistory and we're going to start the real trip, the trip of human history. And that's going to be kind of exciting. I hope I live, you know, long enough to see that. But at least it's satisfying to see the emergence right now of patterns that lead me to see that the prehistory is on its way out. We don't have to live that way anymore. We don't have to live like savages anymore. We can emerge as people, and we can order our societies and our lives. Someone this morning.
Let me come in here and say, yeah, this is KCAC Phoenix.
I keep forgetting about that. Someone this morning said that, as a matter of fact, in an office, a secretary in an office said that she was up at Grand Canyon last weekend. She said it was really fantastic experience because here there was order. There was order. People were doing whatever they wanted to do and interacting and relating. There wasn't disorder, there was order. But no power. All right, there was no police and no rules, no regulations, and here there was order. And everybody just relating and some talking and some, you know, eating picnics and or doing whatever they were doing. And so it was a beautiful vision for her of you know, what could be, what human beings are capable of doing on a mass scale. It seems to me that that's the kind of vision that we have to have. We have to have a vision of a society where order doesn't depend on force, where order doesn't depend on law, where order is a matter of individuals relating on the basis of each other's needs and each other's hopes, each other's fears.
Natural human laws.
Natural human laws replace this. And that's going to take time to create. We're going to have to go through some stages where we, you know, develop the kind of, you know, material conditions that are necessary for that. But that's, you know, the picture of human history that's going to evolve. I got a split. I thank you very, very much.
Can you take about 2 or 3 minutes, Morris, and tell what you think the implications are of what the Board of Regents did to you?
Well,
your reaction to it is, and what your plans for the future are concerning it.
Yeah, well, I think that the Board of Regents have now put all the universities on notice that all their rules and regulations and their, you know, procedures of due process are just window dressing. That the Board of Regents, under pressure from reactionaries in the legislature for whom they have to come to get their money, are going to just simply if they're allowed to do it, eliminate all sorts of ideas and the people who hold those ideas that are not in keeping with the established ideas in Arizona. And I think this is their way of saying we're going to try to block change, we're going to try to block you know, movements for change. I think they're doomed to failure. I think, you know, they'll get me out. We're going to go to court. We're going to fight them. I don't know whether we'll win or lose. That's a legal matter. I'm going to certainly try to find another job. I think that in the long run, they're not going to make it. In the long run, they're, you know, putting a finger in a dike, and they're going to drown. But in the short run, a lot of people are going to suffer. Faculty are going to suffer. Administrators now are going to suffer. They've seen that they're on the other side of this power relation. They don't have, you know, much to say about conditions of the, that affect their lives anymore. What we're seeing is the arbitrary power of a small group of people exercised in a way that makes a shamble out of any pretense at academic freedom, due process, or democratic university. And it's sad. It's going to just, I think, and once the AAUP, which I'm sure it inevitably will, puts these universities, because they're all under the control of Board of Regents, under censure, it'll drive faculty members away, keep other faculty members from coming. They don't want to live under these kind of conditions anyway, even if it weren't censured. People will go, and other people won't come. They don't want to live this way, and it's going to...
I noticed even that Landini is leaving.
Yes, he's going up to the University of Montana to be vice president. I think, though, that it's not going to work. I haven't seen it yet, but I was just informed a little while ago that Joe Patrick, his editorial tonight on TV, is against the action of the Board of Regents. And I think this is the way these kind of things have to be handled. Even though people may disagree with what I think or what I say, they've got to understand that an attack on the university, an attack on an individual in the university, an attack on the public's right to hear and to know, not the old marketplace of ideas thing, that's a tired cliche, but the public, if we really take seriously the notion of democracy, the public has a right to know. The public has a right to make up its own mind on where it's going. And students have to hear, have to be aware of the challenges to the assumptions and the values of the social system that they're being processed to serve. Otherwise, they can't relate to that social system in terms of their own needs and their own interests. And so an attack on anybody in the university and on any aspect of the people's right to know is an attack on the whole structure, on the whole thing. And people across the board should repudiate this. They should really say, this won't do. And even though it isn't going to do anything in my case, it'll at least, if the pressure is strong enough, keep them from, that is the independent, you know, pressure from like all kinds of people of all ages, keep them from doing this again to anyone else.
Could you tell me very briefly your personal feelings? And I mean totally divorced of, I realize the fact that you're out of a job now, which is a drag. And but how do you feel inside, if you will?
Well, a little bit right now at loose ends. I don't really know quite, you know, what's going to be. And it's not an unusual feeling for me. I've been there before. I'll probably be there again. A little bit sad. There are some things here that are very nice, and there's some people here that both Pamela and I have come very close to, and it's a little bit sad having to, you know, sort of pick up and go somewhere else, but that really doesn't matter. I try not to view myself as the center of what's happening. I don't like being subjective about things that I'm involved in. I think it's more important for me to know that it's only in the short run that things are going to change a little bit, and maybe not even in the short run. I'm not, you know, super Jew. I'm Jewish, but I'm not super Jew. I don't create revolutions with the snap of my fingers. I'm certainly not I certainly am not the the cause of the crises in this country, and nor the cause of the reaction to the crises. People's heads get turned around by objective things, and they're gonna move anyway. And wherever I am, I'm gonna try to be part of that movement. And I'm gonna read the Phoenix papers and see that it's still happening here, and they're not gonna stop it from happening here. And I'm gonna be very happy.
Do you consider yourself patriotic?
Yeah, in a sense, I consider myself more patriotic than the rulers of the country. I've got a different kind of sense of patriotism. I think the American people have a fantastic history. Every time I read American history, it just knocks me out. I mean, the real American history, not the American history that you get.
Right,
you
know, I know.
Schools,
yeah.
Real American history just really is out of sight. We've had some really great people in this country and some really great history. And I think it's that tradition in terms of which I'm very, I find myself identifying with the real people and the real masses of Americans who've really struggled and carved out, you know, something that we all take for granted right now. I think that you'll find, by and large, that the rulers of the society are much less patriotic than the revolutionaries in the society. I think revolutionaries are, by and large, motivated, ironically enough, from the point of view of the, you know, the inane flag-waving right. But revolutionaries are very patriotic people, by and large. Their revolutionary ideal is deeply molded by the kind of history of the country that they were born into and have grown up in, and the rulers are the first ones to sell out the people of the country. The first ones to sell out the people. My patriotism is not to the physical things; it's to the people, and that's
which is as the country was set up.
Yeah. Right.
All right, I would like to say one more thing before you leave. Just, this is a very personal feeling. I have a tremendous amount of respect for you. And I say this not because you stood up, because I think anyone in your position would have stood up. I know I would have stood up. But the way you have handled yourself during this entire thing, the fact that you have not resorted to dirty tactics, which have been used on you, the fact that you have been courteous, the fact that you have been civil, the fact that you have been respectful, and the simple fact that you have remained optimistic and buoyant throughout the whole thing, I think is really tremendous.
Thank you very much.
And I'm not trying to lay sentimental BS on you. I truly mean that. And I know that you'll be successful wherever you go and whatever you do, and I really hate to see the things come down on you that have come down, partly because of what they will mean to the city, partly because I realize the implications of what will probably eventually come down on us. When I say us, I mean the station and myself, and partly because I've just grown to like you as a person.
I've been very fortunate. Been an awful lot of people that have done an awful lot of nice things to help, and for good or ill, professors have a certain amount of social status, whatever have you, whatever you want to call it, and have been able and are able to get a lot of mileage out of victimization. But you got to remember, I mean, everybody, you know it, I know you, but people out there have got to remember that my kind of victimization is a trivial kind of victimization and a very public kind of victimization, but the private victimization of zillions of people all over the world every day is enough to make me just, you know, get sick. People who don't have access to the press, people who don't have press conferences, people who don't have social status, poor people, black people, Vietnamese people, radio announcers who get hassled by police. I mean, you know, the private violence and victimization and in some countries and in some places, torture people are going through right now around the world is, you know, just enough to make you want to, you know, choke. But you can't, you know, you fight your own victimization, and little, maybe in that little way you're fighting, you know, against the victimization of everybody that isn't being heard. And but they're there, and we all have to think about them more, in a way, more than the victimization of people who can fight back. It's the powerless people who can't fight back that we really have to dedicate our energies to helping.
I think one thing for the audience to remember is that if the Board of Regents can do something like this to you, who, as you said, you are a member of standing in the society, etc., imagine what they can do to people who have no power each and every day.
Yeah.
And all I've got to say is just ride on, man. Thank you, Morris.
Right on.
And we'll be reading Professor Starsky's statement that he made to the press after this word to remind you maybe what it's all about. This is the statement that was given to the press today by Professor Morris Starsky, and it reads as follows. Yesterday, the Arizona Board of Regents proved that what I have been saying about the university as a social institution is true. The myth of the independent, a political university dedicated to the unfettered pursuit of knowledge, has finally been shattered in Arizona. In a capitalist society, there is no distinction between public property and private corporate property. Both are controlled by small groups of rich white people. There are no blacks in the Board of Regents. There are no Chicanos. There are no Indians. There are no workers. There are no students. There are no poor people. The university is a factory operated at public expense, but not in the public interest. Its products are research for private industry and students who have been sufficiently processed to serve a social system without questioning its assumptions or values in terms of their own needs and aspirations. The Regents have made it quite clear that they are afraid of radical ideas and that they intend to silence their expression, no matter what the cost to the people of Arizona. They have repudiated the judgment of the chairman of my department, the dean of the College of Liberal Arts, the ad hoc committee, the Committee on Academic Freedom and Tenure, and the president of the university. In so doing, they have revealed that academic due process is mere window dressing for their arbitrary power. The people of Arizona, however, will have to pay the price for this exercise of power. The Regents can always send their sons and daughters out of state. The sons and daughters of Arizona's workers who have the right to the best education the state can afford will not get that education when the state universities are censured by AAUP. The Regents hope to avoid censure and an expensive legal battle by attempting to buy me off. But I intend to fight. not only for the sabbatical leave which the regents acknowledge I have earned, but for my job as well. The answer to the arbitrary power of the regents lies not only in the courts, but in the consciousness and independent organizations of the people. The struggles for academic freedom, economic justice, and political justice are all part of the struggle for a genuinely democratic society. Now that the students, faculty, and administrators of Arizona State University have been exposed to the power relationship on which the university rests, perhaps they will come to recognize that having a socialist professor is not merely a matter of tolerating diversity, but serves a definite political need in the struggle for their freedom. A statement by Professor Morris Starsky. And this is a statement by KCAC Radio.